First of all, I'd like to express my appreciation at the given the honour of being able to learn a few, think through a few ideas with you. I would like to express the idea that I have tremendous admiration for this particular institution. Rabbi Sher is the kind of person who likes a lot of speeches made about him in public. But I think it's absolutely amazing what's been achieved here. If I were Zerka to come back to learn in Eretz Yisrael, then I would come and learn in this place if you would have me, and if by that time you hadn't become too advanced for me. But it's a great honor to be able to share some ideas with you. So let's think through something which I think is fundamental in the area of what we call Machshava or Shkafa, whatever you want to call it, which is something that's not well understood and something that's fundamental. My own contact with this idea is interesting. I'll just mention very briefly how it came about, and that is that I had the interesting experience some time ago of having to deal with a Buddhist Jew, right? I don't know if you're aware, you are in your little bubble of Kedusha here, not so much in contact with the unreal world out there. But in America today, probably about a third of Buddhists are Jewish, right? A third of the Zen Buddhists in America are Jewish. Probably close to 300,000 Jews are card-carrying Zen Buddhists in America. And most of the Zen Buddhist leadership in America today is Jewish. In fact, not only that, by the way, they also have a large group of American Jews who are Jewish and Buddhist. They call themselves Jew-Boos. Thank you very much. And they practice both Judaism and Buddhism. There's a Buddhist shul in San Francisco. That's where we hold it. So what happened was, one of these fellows, who's a very refined and articulate and intelligent Jew from Chicago, wrote me a letter, somehow got hold of me through South African friends in Chicago, with a problem being, his problem was that he was an ordained Buddhist priest, this Jewish guy, from a background with zero Judaism. He grew up in a family with five siblings, four of whom are married, and all married to non-Jews. And when he married a Jewish girl, his parents almost disowned him. When he took up Buddhism, his parents said that as long as it's not Orthodox Judaism, we want you to go in that direction. And he became an ordained Buddhist. And then his wife, who's very Jewishly motivated, she is the chazan in a Reform temple, his wife, who's very Jewishly motivated, felt that Buddhism is idolatrous and got very upset with his involvement in Buddhism. And in order to save his marriage, he decided to investigate whether he could find the same meditational intensity and opening of the dais, or whatever you want to call it, in Judaism. And so he started learning with some Orthodox people in Chicago. Eventually he somehow wrote me a letter, and we ended up corresponding for a long time. And then we decided to publish the results of that correspondence, because it might be useful to many of those Jews, particularly in America, who are Zen Buddhists. By the way, there's plenty all over the world. In England, a friend of mine recently was traveling to Newcastle on a plane. There was a guy in saffron robe sitting next to him. He was going to a Buddhist monastery in Newcastle. My friend asked him his name, and he said his name is David Cohen. Right? So he's a Tibetan Buddhist, not a Zen Buddhist. So you have a fascinating phenomenon, and it's something we'll talk about in its own way. But one of the questions that he asked me, his first letter to me contained 14 very good questions. Very good questions. Why do Jews have to be different, for example? Why can't we all be universally the same? And the longest of his question was, if you Jews believe in complete achdus, then why can't we all melt into the same achdus? Why do you have to have a Jewish identity that's different from others? Why are the Jews I meet not particularly spiritual? As Rav Moshe Shapiro himself says, if you go to India and you watch a Buddhist monk meditating on the sunrise, it's very impressive. You can see him sit there, concentrate for 6 hours on the meaning of the sunrise. Then you go to Shakris in some places, the intensity of the Kalam is not always that impressive. So he wrote me, that's a question that bothers him, right? Why the Jews, if Judaism is what it's supposed to be, why are its exponents not as refined and spiritual as some of the people he saw in the East? There are a lot of very good questions that need dealing with, things like korbanos that bother him. Why do you have to kill animals? What does a korban mean? Eating meat altogether. And I had to struggle to answer his questions the best I could. And eventually we published that as a book, and it was a wonderful opportunity for me to have to think through some basics that I had perhaps taken for granted, And I'd like to share with you one of them that was a question that came up through our discussion. And when our Rebbe Rav Shapiro was in England some time ago, I put the question to him. And then in a chabura that we zochet to have there, he worked through what turned out to be an answer to that question. And I'd like to share that with you. It's a fundamental of Torah and Yiddishkeit. It's something that's not well understood. It's something where we are at extreme variance from all other religions, cults, sects, etc. And therefore, it's fundamental to understand. The question's like this. Stay with me carefully now, because we have a few questions to put, and then we can try to work through them all with one theme. If I asked anyone in this room, or any educated Westerner, even a non-Jew, what was the fundamental principle that Avraham Avinu brought to the world? What did Abraham bring to the world that became the cornerstone of what Judaism is? Right? What is the fundamental philosophical notion that Avraham Avinu brought to the world? 99% of Westerners would give me one word as an answer. Namely, monotheism. Right? Look in any history book, school history book. Judaism brought monotheism to the world. And it's wrong. It's wrong. It is not what he brought to the world. Right? Let's try to establish why that is, and then try to figure out what exactly was his Hiddush, which is what our essence really is. First of all, and this is a question that many B'nai Torah struggle with, right? It's a very good question, and that is, why do we credit Avraham Avinu with bringing the idea of a monotheistic Torah to the world, when Shem and Ava were already teaching the same Torah? Shem and Ava, right, were there long before he was. Shem was there from before the Mabul, and was teaching 100% authentic Torah. Right? He was a Navi. He was Malchi Tzedek, who gave a bracha to Avraham Avinu. He was on the Madrega of Nevuah. They were teaching 100% authentic Torah. So why do we go back to Avraham Avinu as the great Mechadesh, who brought to the world this new idea of a Yediyas Hashem against idolatry? The beginner has this idea that the world was completely lost in idolatry. All they were doing was worshipping idols. His own father, right? You know the story, Medrash made all the idols. They're completely forgotten, like the Rambam says, that the Shachachu is the Iker HaGadol, they'd forgotten this Gadol, meaning Hashem's existence. And Avraham Avinu, a three-year-old child, comes on the scene, 3 or 12 or 48, whatever it was. He comes on the scene and he realizes there's Hashem, and he has a whole debate with Nimrod, and finally gets thrown into fire, and he survives miraculously. And ultimately, when he's 75, he has this Nevuah. Yeah, like the Medrash says, yeah, Ani Baal Abira. Hashem appears to him and says, yes, you're right, I'm the one you've been seeking and identifying. If that's true, that he brings this idea to the world, what was Shem and Ava doing? That means there's a serious stir here. The Medrash that gives you to believe, that a beginner reads believing, that no one knew about Hashem, and Avraham Avinu comes upon the scene and he founds this idea, completely misses the point that Shem and Ava were there long before him teaching exactly the same Torah. So what was the Mechadesh? No, what would you say?
We've been learning this sugya for the last year in this yeshiva.
Oh, really?
Why did Avram choose a derech other than Nach Tzadik? Forget about Nimrod and his father, but what was Nach Tzadik? Right. What was new about Avram's derech as opposed to Nach Tzadik?
Yes, okay. So there is one line of thinking here that identifies his chiddush as kiruv. Kiruv.
Kisik Mishnah.
Going out and calling, yeah? Vayikra, B'Shem Hashem, etc. He was the first one to call the name Adonis in the world. Okay, there's a whole mahalach there. But I'd like to suggest to you that there's something else here much deeper. You see, first of all, that's not monotheism. That's the spread of monotheism. But you wouldn't credit him with a philosophical chiddush. Shem and Ava already teaching that, right? And not only that, we know he met Shem. Even if you're going to say, well, he was Mechadesh Adonis, first of all, why credit him with being the first, right? If he wasn't really the first. And secondly, he met Shem. Right? Secondly, you have to know, Shem and Ava's Torah was 100% authentic. First Raya, when Yaakov Avinu spends 14 years learning Torah intensely, he learns in the yeshiva of Shem and Ava. By the way, that's a kasha in its own right. What did he hope to learn in 14 years by Shem and Ava that he had not already learned by his grandfather and by his father? He already learned by Avraham Avinu. He learned by Yitzhak, right? What did he hope to gain from yeshiva Shem and Ava? Okay, he was running away. And you could argue some superficial argument geographically. It was on the border where Esav couldn't get. But he spent 14 specific years picking up their Torah. So first of all, you see it was definitely authentic. It was good enough for Yaakov Avinu to learn there. And a side question which we'd like to deal with also is, what was the unique Torah that he wanted to get there that he'd not gotten from Avraham Yitzhak? Secondly, when Rivka had a question that needed answer of Nevuah, she went to ask Shem. She had a pregnancy that was peculiar. She walked past the place of Kedusha and the pregnancy responded. She walked past the place of Avodah Zorah or Gashmias, whatever you want to say, and that responded too. There's a paradox in this child. She goes to Shane, who's a Novi, and B'Nevuah, he tells her, Shnei Goyim B'Vitnech, you have two children, Yaakov Esav, that explains the dichotomy. And she was, first note, first thing you note, is that Shane was good enough to give an answer of P'Nevuah, right? He definitely was valid and kosher. And as a second side question, why didn't she ask Avramavi? Why didn't she ask her father-in-law? She was married to the son of probably the greatest Novi, maybe the greatest human being who ever lived. She didn't ask him. She went to ask Shane. Why? That needs thought. Okay, next. By the way, there's a misconception we need to dispel here, which in itself is a whole discussion. I'm not sure we have time to. I don't know if we can go into. What time is this session?
When you stop.
When I stop.
Shkia. He wants that minchah. Shkia is at 10:07. Mar is quarter past 8.
Okay, there's a misconception here that we need to dispel. Let's try and at least spend a little time on that. And that is that people think that if the generation was involved in Avodah Zorah, in idolatry, then by definition they'd forgotten about Hashem. And that is another misconception. Avodah Zorah does not mean forgetting about Hashem. The immature conception is that idolatry means that instead of worshipping God, you worship an idol, right? You carve a statue in wood or stone, and then you bow down. Yeah. That's not the concept of Avodah Zorah. I don't understand. That's a serious misconception. What I'm trying to prove to you is that a generation that is absolutely sunk in Avodah Zorah has not necessarily forgotten about Hashem. Not at all. Avodah Zorah means something else. And very briefly, without going into too much detail, it means this. The beginner's misconception is that Avodah Zorah is a person who doesn't know about Hashem or conveniently excludes him. And he takes some effigy, some image, some icon, and he worships that. But you have to realize, a person who takes a piece of wood, like the Navi says, he takes a log of wood, cuts half of it up into firewood, the other half carves a statue, and then bows down to the statue saying that it made him, doesn't need religious help. That kind of person needs psychiatric help. Right? That's not a philosophical problem, that's a psychiatric problem. A person who takes a shape of wood, in wood or stone, and then that he made, and then says that it made him or has divine power, yeah, we're not talking about idiots. The Torah isn't speaking to Rishonim or to idiots. Well, that's not the concept. The concept is Avodah Zorah. The concept, without going into the whole discussion, Avodah Zorah is not a person who misunderstands, who thinks that the power, the root of power in the world, is an image. Avodah Zorah is a person who knows full well about Hashem. Right? The Rambam says that the early idolaters used to call Hashem Elokah de Elohim. Yeah? The Elokah de Elohim. He is the God of all the gods. They knew about him. The mistake of idolatry is that a person, yeah, they understand, are very clear in the Rambam also, in Hilchos Akum, the idolatry is like this. A person understands that Hashem is the root cause, but he emanates his effect into the world through intermediaries, which he does, call them malachim, call them mazalos, call them ultimately the powers of nature. The Rambam in the first Chelek of Moreh Nevuchim says that any power of nature is a malach. What makes grass grow? In a blade of grass is a vital force, as opposed to a blade of grass that's dead. That what you biologically call an energy that makes the grass grow, so it's a form of malach. Particularly madrega of malach. Malachim, Hashem relates to the world through various intermediaries. The sun, the moon, the wind, the forces of chemistry, physics, etc. They are all these intermediaries. Idolatry is not forgetting about Hashem, but it's looking up. See, if you want to make a very childish picture, Hashem is, as it were, at the top. And he emanates down in Kabbalah. What's written is each madrega brings out another madrega beneath it. That one brings out another madrega, another olam, if you like. Eventually, the second last of all the olamas is called the mazalos. Without going into detail, the stars, and finally, you reach this world here that we inhabit, which is known as Asiya. Idolatry is a person who looks up in that chain of causality, and he looks at the correct chain, but he doesn't go all the way. He conveniently stops at an intermediary. An idolater is not a person who forgets about Hashem and thinks that a star is the creator of the world. An idolater is a person who goes to the mazalos, and instead of going beyond them to the source of the mazalos, he thinks you can deal with the intermediary and you need not go to the source. You know, I can't put it better than Rav Simcha Wasserman Zatzal. He used to put it like this. He used to say, an idolater is a person who walks into a department store and he goes to the fellow behind the counter and he says, that camera there costs $1,500. I have only 150. I'll slip you the 150. You slip me the camera. That's idolatry. It's a fellow who feels that he can deal with the guy who runs the department as opposed to the guy who owns the store. Why? Because the fellow who runs the department is the fellow who delivers the goods. And that's what I'm concerned with. The fellow who owns the store is irrelevant to me. I want to deal with the stars. And that's why you have the Greeks, for example, right? They had a god of love, a god of war, a god of fertility, a god of wealth. There was no Greek god who created the world. Why? He's irrelevant. He doesn't deliver me the goods. In other words, idolatry is a person who goes to the intermediary, not because he doesn't know there's something beyond him, but because what's beyond him is irrelevant. Is this clear? And the mistake of idolatry is thinking that the intermediary can be dealt with, that he has any decision-making power. That is ridiculous and laughable, and where the Navi mocks, and the only thing you're allowed to mock, right? Because mockery is one of the worst midas in the personality. But mockery is a mitzvah when it comes to Avodah Zarah, which is a mockery of reality. And what you mock in Avodah Zarah is not the fact that it's not a valid intermediary. What you mock is the notion that this intermediary has some originating power. That's ridiculous. He's only a transmitting channel, right? And he can't make... You know, it's for this reason that some people refuse to say any even psukim sometimes or anything that seems to relate to an intermediary. There are people who won't sing Shalom Aleichem on Friday night, you know. There are many people who do not sing Shalom Aleichem. Because one of the stanzas there says Baruch Hu Neshalom. You're speaking to a malach, you're saying Baruch Hu Neshalom. You could make the mistake of thinking that this malach can make a decision whether to give you a bracha or not. For that reason, there's other reasons too. But for that reason, people don't say. There's places in Slichas when you talk about you seem to be speaking to Midas Harachami. Midas Harachami, Amenu His Galgali. As if you're speaking to a Midah of Hashem. You could make the mistake of thinking that the Midah can be spoken to, as if he can, and that's a tragic error. Right? So again, idolatry is not a question of having forgotten Hashem. The Rambam says it openly. The Rambam says the early idolaters got into that mistake because they said, if Hashem is the great king and he decides to work through certain emissaries like the sun and the moon and the wind, isn't it fitting to give honor to his emissaries like he would the messenger of a king? So they started doing that. Then conveniently they forgot about the king. Forgot means decided that he's not necessary to relate to. By the way, you know, that's why the second last layer of all these layers is the Muslim. The mazolos are always 12. You know the 12 mazolos, right? 12. 12 always means where the oneness becomes split into many. That's always what 12 means, right? 12 is always the symbol of multiplicity. 13 is always how many are contained in one. 12 is always, if you take any three-dimensional structure in its most stylized form, like a cube, right? Cube is surrounded by 12 bordering lines, bounding lines. What are known in Kabbalah as the Yud-based Kavei Alachzon. A cube, right? A cubic room has got four lines there, eight, and the four lines that join them. Yes? The three dimensions, six facets, and 12 boundary lines. So 12 is always the full expression of the physical world. The 13th is the fact that the lines are all connected into one. That's why Echad in Lashon Kodesh is Gematria 13. Ahava is also 13, because it means two becoming one. Right? It's for you. So,
sorry, but why is it cube?
It's a separate discussion, but just for now, the key is like this. We talk about three dimensions, right? Are you unhappy with that?
Yeah,
okay. Three dimensions is six directions. Are you happy with that? Left, right, front, back, up, down. You don't object to that. The simplest version of three dimensions, yeah, which is six expressions, is the six facets of a cube. That's the most simple, stylized notion. It means that when you simplify the thing into its minimal symbol, you can't get more basic than that. An octagon is much more complex three-dimensional structure than a cube. The cube is the simplest expression of six directions. You could build any three-dimensional object by specifying its coordinates on the faces of a cube. You don't need more than that. Are you with me? And a cube is bounded by 12 lines. There needs much more explanation than that, but that's for now that.
Ralph, why only three dimensions? Why not?
Because the world has three dimensions. If you're asking why he didn't create it differently, it's an invalid question.
We only see three, but perhaps there are more.
No, I'm talking about three spatial dimensions. Oh. No one argues with that. A point moving describes a line moving describes a plane moving describes a volume, a cube. No? Let's not get into that now. That's a whole, way off the subject. Okay? I just want to point out to you that the physical world consists of 12 elements. The 13th, which you can't see, always bonds it together. That's why 13 is such a Jewish number. Because our essence, and we'll come back to this, our essence is making many into one. And that's why the Kohen, in general, are allergic to 13. Right? In non-Jewish culture, in the Esav culture, 13 is hysterically dangerous. 13, they won't sit and seat 13, buy a ticket 13, buy a house number 13. You can't... What?
There's no floor 13.
That's right, that's right. The reason is because in Pneumius they understand what's Esav's koyach, ki yesh li roiv, achi, I have many. He's not interested in making many into one. Yaakov Avinu has 17 nefashes and he calls them nefesh, one. Esav has 12 and he calls them nefashes, many, right? Etc. 12, by the way. So, the mazalos are 12. Why? Because the function of the mazal is to split the oneness above into the many that comes down here. So an idolater is a person that looks up to the source of multiplicity. That means he identifies the source of each thing that comes down here, and he deals with that. What the oneness is behind it is not what delivers the goods, and therefore is not interested in that. So the outcome we want, output we want here, is that Avodah Zarah is not a forgetting about Hashem. It's just a choosing not... Of course, you realize the one further step. One further step. He's not interested in intermediaries. What he's really interested in is who the goods are being delivered to. That's why it says, Tzadikim Elokeim Oimdim Aleim, right? Tzadikim, Hashem stands over them. Like it says, Hashem Nitzav Olav. God stands over them. He looks up to Hashem. Rashoim Heim Oimdim Al Elohim. The Rasha stands over his God. Like it says, Uparo Oimed Ala Yoav. He stands over the Nile, which was the idolatrous vision of the Egyptians. He tells his God what he wants him to do. See, again, the real difference here is not just intermediaries. The real difference is who's serving whom. Avodas Hashem means, Hashem, I'm here for you. Ask not what you can do for your country. What your country can do for you, what you know. Avodas Hashem, I'm here for you. Avodah Zarah, I'm telling you what you need to do for me. By the way, I just want to hear this in very sharp contrast. You know that Islam is not idolatrous, but Christianity is. Right? Christianity is. Rambam talks about this. Christianity, how does it begin? How does Yiddishkeit begin? How does Judaism begin? With a man sacrificing his son for Hashem. How does Christianity begin? With God sacrificing his son for us. There's no accident there. Who's serving whom? Who's here to... Do you understand what... So, that's the concept. Now, let's go back. In Avraham Avinu's day, people were idolatrous. That doesn't mean they've forgotten about Hashem. They were not interested in Hashem. They were dealing with the intermediaries because they thought if you sacrifice your child and you do this and you do that, you can manipulate the intermediaries and get what you need. So don't think when he smashed the idols and taught people about Hashem, he was telling them something new. He wasn't telling them something new in that Hashem exists. Is this? Okay. So let's go back to our questions. What was he Mechadish? Shem and Eva were teaching Torah already. They were valid. They were on the Madrega of Nevuah. Rivka asked a question from Shem. Yaakov Avinu went to learn them. One more question. I mean, there are many we could ask, but let's ask one more question. You know that the generation of the people who built the tower would be known as the Dor HaPalaga, right? The Dor HaPalaga, the generation that was dispersed. They tried to build a tower to reach the center of the universe, argue, fight, do battle with Hashem himself, and wrest control of the universe into their own hands, right? And how did Hashem thwart and obstruct their plan? Hashem said, let us go down and babble their language. Bavel, by the way, is where it occurred, which is the babble of language. Let us split their language, was originally Lashon Kodesh, which in its simplest version is called Hebrew, but in its deeper version is Nevuah, right? The language of creation. Let us break their language into all languages. The childish concept is that they spoke Hebrew, and then Hashem zapped them so that now this one spoke Zulu, that one spoke in Chinese, they couldn't understand each other. It's not the meaning. The meaning is they spoke Lashon Kodesh before, a language which is creative, a language which words don't speak about things, the words are the thing. You know that in Hebrew is the only language on earth in which the word for a word is the same as the word for a thing. In English, a thing and a word are two different words. In Lashon Kodesh, davar is a word and davar is a thing. Because the deepest essence of anything in the world is the word that Hashem said that brought it into existence. Hashem didn't give instructions, Vayomer Elokim. He wasn't giving instructions. He was uttering a word, which then condensed into, became the thing. The Rambam says, you understand this, that when a Navi spoke, you didn't hear a man speaking, you experienced what he was saying. Because he wasn't talking about things, he was saying the things. We don't do that. We talk about things, and hopefully the other person, usually the other person doesn't got a clue what you're saying. And if he thinks he does, he understands the opposite. Usually. Walk out of this shir and ask three different people what the shir was about. You'll hear three completely different things. That's our communication. But in the generation of Nevuah, when a person spoke, you experienced what he said. There was no possibility of misunderstanding.
I was going to ask if it was a Navi experienced Hashem. Hashem was telling him, or is it all ordinary average human being that a
Navi
spoke to experience?
The Rambam says, if a Navi spoke to you, you experienced what the Navi was saying. You didn't hear a person describing something. He was completely knocked out of his senses. He became a vehicle, the Rambam says, he collapsed. Yeah. He was completely. Okay, now, what were they trying to do? They were trying to build some sort of structure that could reach into the center of creation and take control. By what means? By language. They were Dvarim Achadim. They spoke one language. They were so united in their purpose and their tool that they were able to recreate the world in their image. By the way, what does that mean? What do you think they were building? A tower, putting bricks together? It says they were building Ir Umigdal. And in Plimius, in the deepest form, what it says is what they were trying to build. See, the children are taught they were building a tower. You know, they were very primitive. They thought if you put enough bricks together, you could get high enough, you reach God. They were trying to build Ir Umigdal, which always means Yushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. Ir is always Yushalayim. Migdal, Kemigdal, Tzavarech, has many, many hints in Torah, Shir HaShir, many other places, that Migdal is the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because Yushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash is the way you get in contact with the center of the world. That's where Hashem Himself manifests in the world. They were trying to build that on the dark side. They were trying to build the dark equivalent, the negative facet, of what we call Yerushalayim in the Beis HaMikdash, so that they could go into that center of creation, and there they could manipulate and take over control. And they could have done it. They could have done it. How? Because they spoke the language of creation. The raya is that the way Hashem had to stop them was by stopping that language. Now he came down, cracked up that language, so that now it fragmented into the kind of language we speak. Never mind Hebrew, Zulu, Chinese, that's not the issue. Into the kind of language that no longer is the thing itself. And since that was fragmented, they were not, except for one person, Avraham Avinu, who retained the prophetic ability and began a nation of people who had more than 1 million prophets over the next 1,000 years. Now, what did the success of their thing depend on? The unity of all people on earth. By the way, what is the idea behind that? The idea was that Adam HaRishon, Adam, was created with ability to create worlds. In Kabbalah is written that the Malachim, when they saw Adam, when the angels saw Adam, they tried to worship him. They couldn't tell the difference between him and Hashem. According to Kabbalah Sforim, Adam HaRishon inhabited a world that you daven to today. That's where he was. Only from his waist down, stretched into the natural world. Whatever that means. So he was absorbed into the level that we can't begin to understand. Right? That's who he was. And with that ability, he was able to reform the world. And he did. When he performed the chait that he did, the world crashed into this. Now, they thought like this. Since his avera, since the chait of Adam HaRishon fragmented the world, instead of one cosmic human being, into millions and millions of fragmentary bits and pieces of individual human beings, if we re-coalesce into one unit, if we get all human beings on earth together, we reform that unity with that language, then we could arrive at that power that he had and reform the world in our image. And they were right. They were right. And Hashem had to thwart that by splitting them into many. That's why the success of their plan depended on all humans being united. And that's why they tried to kill Avraham Avinu. Why did they try to kill him? Because they were Me'ever Mizeh, and he was Avraham, right? Me'ever Mizeh. He was on the other side. And if there was somebody opposed to their plan, all humans would not be united. And he had to go. That's the kasha. See, marriage hasn't softened his brain. That's the kasha. I'll get there slowly. Avraham Avinu was against their plan, so Nimrod, who was the center of this whole enterprise, decided the only way that we can have a true unity against Hashem is if we kill him. And the only reason they didn't was because they failed. They threw him into a fire. He survived miraculously. So the Medrash says, after he survived miraculously, they said, "Pray da zu akarahi, this old donkey, Avraham Avinu." And his wife are sterile, they cannot have children, so therefore we'll put up with them until they die. We tried to kill him, we failed. By the way, this reminds me, just on a political note, this reminds me that when the Israeli army was set up in Gurion's day, There was a major argument here in Israel about whether the army should be kosher. There was a major uproar in Israel about whether the Israeli army should serve kosher food. Why? Because one faction said there's soldiers who need to eat kosher food. The other faction said, we don't care about that. But this is a secular democracy. And if the army, which is an organ of the state, serves kosher food, that's a religious statement. That's not the will of the people. It wasn't an argument about whether individuals should eat kosher food. It was an ideological argument, and it was a massive uproar. How was it solved? They went to Ben-Gurion with a problem, and Ben-Gurion said, look, give them kosher food. In one more generation, there's going to be none of them left anyway. That's what he said. And that's how the argument was solved, and that's how the Israeli army began serving kosher food. They were clear that in one more generation. What? It's a well known.
Source for them, we can quote people who argue on that.
I can't think of the explicit source. Yeah, give me time to check it again and find out. A lot of these stories came down through Navon, who was with Ben-Gurion. He was with Ben-Gurion during the meeting, the famous meeting with the Chazon Ish. And that's been analyzed recently. You better speak to me after I'll tell you some of that. Whether it came down from him, what?
Shlomo Lawrence's books.
Okay. So, but be that as it may, I have an authoritative source for what happened at Avraham Avinu's time, which is more important. And that is that they said, the Midrash says, they said, wait till he dies and then we'll have the world to ourselves. Here's the question. How come they never tried to kill Shem Va'Evir? There's no record in any Midrash that Shem Va'Evir went. Now, they stood exactly for the same values. They were teaching exactly the same Torah. So how come it was necessary to kill Avraham else it couldn't work? Shem Va'Evir were no problem for them. Why? They were not part of the Migdal Babel. They were teaching Torah Sashem. They definitely were opposed to the program. They were no problem.
Were they still alive at that point?
Were they still alive?
I found it.
I think so.
Yaakov
went there. Yaakov went to learn. Yeah, Yaakov went to learn there in two generations later.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Now, in fact, that was only a few years after the Mabul, right? Only a few years after the Mabul, which was in 1656, right? Avraham Avinu was when Noach died, Avraham was 58 years old. He was 58 years old. I'm not really Noach. So yeah, it was very soon. Very soon. Okay, now let's try to answer these questions and build a yesod that's really a yesod. It's like this. What Avraham Avinu brought to the world was a unique idea. And the unique idea was something like this. Perhaps the way to approach it is to back up a bit and just give the history. What was the spiritual problem? What was the spiritual essence, if you like, of the world, and what went wrong? Adam Arishan, when Adam was created, he was a person who uniquely combined body and soul. That's what you said. What we call Gashmias and Ruchnias, right? Physicality and spirituality, which are the two warring factions in the world, what are known in Kabbalistically as male and female, or the source of all duality, what's called in Kabbalistic works, Oires and Kalim, lights and vessels, the Neshama is a light and the vessel, the body is the vessel. This duality, which is the nature of a created world, was unified and resolved in Adam HaRishon in such a way that the vehicle, the body, was no obstruction to the Neshama. Instead of being at war, these two elements were in harmony. How do we see that? Many ways. I'll give one beautiful way of seeing it. The Midrash says, based on the Gemara and the Midrash say, that Adam HaRishon was clothed in garments of light. What's called kosmos or Aleph Vav Resh. It means he wore garments of light. First of all, he wore no garments. So what does garments of light mean? He was naked. So what is the garment of light? It means his skin was made out of light. What does that mean? What's being said here? Light is the medium of Gilui, of revelation. If you wear a garment of light, it means that there's nothing to obstruct vision. I see through you. Adam Rishon was transparent. He was transparent. When you looked at him, you saw his neshama. The body was not. If you want a very crude sort of an image, it's like if you look today at a human being, you see the opposite. Today we're the opposite. All you see is the body. And if you look very carefully on the face of somebody who's very advanced and very spiritually evolved, who worked on himself for many years, you can see Chochmas Adam Tayyiponov. You can see a certain glow on the face. But it's very, you have to have eyes to see. Adam Rishon was the opposite. When you looked at him, you saw the Neshama. And if you looked very, very carefully, you could make out the wisp of a body. It's like looking at a 1,000-watt globe where the light hurt your eyes. You'd have to look very carefully to see the outline of the glass. That's how he was. He was clothed in light. You could see the inside from the outside. The body was no obstruction to the neshama. It was such a loyal servant of the neshama that it was on the madrega of kedusha of the neshama, and you could see right through. What happened in the chet? When Adam sinned, Adam Rishon sinned, and he brought the body into its own domain of expression, then the body became an obstruction to the neshama. The way the Medrash puts it is that he was clothed in kosnois or aleph vavresh, and after the chet he became clothed in ayin vavresh or. You know, there's a klal in Hebrew pnimius that when an aleph in a word becomes transposed into an ayin, it represents a transition of that concept from spiritual to physical. Do you know that amazing idea? So it's a marvelous thing. I once made a list of many, many words. Same word spelt with an aleph and with an ayin. I mean, for example, the word ein, aleph yud nun. This is a whole subject in its own right. Just understanding Hebrew is enough to make you through. I said, no, you want to do Kirub, all you need to understand is the human language. Anybody who resists that is either not listening, you know, or not listening. But the word Ein, which means is not revealed, right? Yesh me'ayin, something revealed from something that was not revealed before, Ein. When you change the Aleph to an Ayin, you get Ayin, the organ that does reveal, that brings it into the revealed. Ayin means a spring, for example, Ma'ayan, right? Where the water, unrevealed under the ground, comes up and is seen. It's a fantastic klal. Think about it and you see many, many versions. But Aleph Vavresh means he's clothed in light. When it becomes Ayin Vavresh, it becomes skin. The word Ayin Vavresh spells Iver, blind. That means Aleph Vavresh means he's clothed in what enables you to see him. Ayin Vavresh means, by the way, why do they call this a hide in English? Why is this called a thick hide? You see what's happening? So, and that's why he needed to wear clothing. Before, he never needed to wear clothing because the body was no contradiction to the neshama. Why do you feel ashamed without clothes? What's the source of shame? The source of shame, why do you feel embarrassed when you walk around without clothes? If you have any refinement or sensitivity, you feel a hallmark of a Jew, right? One of the three hallmarks of a Jew is feeling a natural modesty, a natural shame. You walk around without clothes on. You know why? Because you have a deep awareness that you're inwardly an angelic being, and outwardly, look like a horse. Outwardly, you look like an animal. There's a schism, there's a dichotomy that's set up between the spiritual inner being housed in the body that is exactly like a gorilla, exactly like a horse, exactly like an animal.
So what's the other two?
Other two what? He's Rahmanim and Baishanim and Gevle Chasadim. Kind, not cruel, right? Do acts of kindness, a natural tendency, and natural shame. Those are three hallmarks of the Jew. That's another discussion. If you, yeah, again, Adam Rishon is created as a being whose inside and outside are on complete harmony and needs no covering, then falls into a situation where the Gashmias becomes at war with the Ruchnias. And the response, of course, is to hide the body. Of course, the trick we use, as Yidden, the trick we use is we use the problem to become the solution. We hide the body with garments that don't only hide the body, but show the dignity of the body. The purpose of garments isn't only to hide the animal. When a king wears royal garments, they do two things. They hide the king, and they reveal his royalty. That's why clothes are so important. Right? Do you know that the word levush, which means a garment, the medaktikim say, is derived from loyboish, to not be ashamed. Right? And of course, the opposite version is the word beged. Beged in Hebrew, which means a garment, means treachery. Because when you don't have any clothes on, and the outside is seen from the inside, then what you see is what you get. As soon as you put a garment on, yeah, you know the old English word for a traitor? Was a turncoat. He wore the coat. By the way, the word coat in Hebrew, me'il, means exactly the same thing. Me'il, which is an outer garment, is the same as me'ila. Me'ila means betraying kedusha. A treachery of taking something from the inner sanctum that's hidden inside and being treacherous. Right? By the way, our Kabbalah, the way this works is, you know that Aleph is always the letter of Kedusha. Aleph is the letter of the Neshama, that's why it has no sound in the world. It always means Chibur of Elyonim et Achtonim, two Yuds connected by Vav, Aleph, Aluf, etc., etc., etc. The Hebrew alphabet begins Aleph, which is Kedusha, and the next three letters are Beis Gimel Dalet Beged. There's the Neshama inside, and coming down into the next three elements that are being spelled out are the clothing of the Neshama, right? As it manifests, as it is. Now,
about the other room, other letters that I think in the expression.
Which other expressions? They all sound. There's no other silent jutta. Iron is made in the throat. It's a guttural.
Right.
Not only aleph is the only silent letter. You know when you say it. Iron is one of five gutturals, right? And it's pronounced iron. You especially listen to Sephardi, listen to Yemenites. It's a sounded letter. There's no question. On the contrary, aleph is spiritual. It's silent. Iron begins to be expressed because it's fallen now into that which is in gutturals. But that's another discussion. But the point is that. So here's the problem. Let's get it clear. Adam Rishon is a man, a being, whose inside and outside are in harmony. What does chait do? Throws the two into conflict. The body becomes fallen, problematic, lecherous. For example, before the chait, what did he ate? What did he eat? He ate food that was absorbed in the body in such a way that there was no excretion. There was no excretion. By the way, that's why Klal Yisrael, when they got back to the matzav of Adam Rishon Kodem HaChait, there was no excretion. They ate man, which was nivla be'evorim, absorbed into the body. There was no excretion. The Medrash says the only time they needed to excrete, which is why they had a mitzvah of spades, right, to dig, was when they bought food from Arabs that they passed in the desert. But when they ate man, there was no excretion. The body before was that kind of a pure thing. Al pi Kabbalah, there was no possibility of excretion because Adam and Chava were formed back to back. There was no back. There was no organs of excretion. Right?
Isn't
that
the
mila
of the food, not the
mila
of the person then?
You have to be that sort of a person to eat that sort of food. Do you know what the man was? The Ramban says the man was crystallized shechina. You had to be the dor der to be able to eat man. If you're on that madrega, you get that kind of food and then you... So, the... you notice we don't get that today. You know why it's called man? Because it is so high that you couldn't even give it a specific name. So they called it, what is it? You know that the Torah technique of expressing, using a word to express something that can never be expressed, is to not say what it is, but to ask what it is. Ma gadlu ma'aseh Hashem. Ma rabu ma'aseh. Mi kamoicha ba'edim. You see, in English, people think it's a Shakespearean rhetorical device. Oh, how goodly, oh, how great. But it's not like that. It means when you can't say what a thing is and you have to talk about it, so you ask the question of what it is, because that never limitation. Man means, what is this? So anyway, the point is that here's the problem. Man was created to be a being whose body and soul, those potentially warring, conflicting elements, are resolved in harmony. The chait splits them into two. Now, what was the response to that problem? Throughout history, there's been one response. In every religion and every sect and every cult, right, to the best of my knowledge, there's always been one response to that problem. Get rid of the body. Become a monk, a nun, an ascetic, a celibate, meditate on a mountaintop, go live in a cave, wear a simple... Yeah. As soon as you let the body speak, it's going to bring the neshama down. The body is irredeemable. It's lecherous, problematic, sensual. It's the opposite of Kedusha and Ruchnius. And if you want to reach Kedusha, the body's your enemy. Think about it for a moment. Christianity. I mean, you can go wherever you like. Christianity. Christianity is and major hang-ups with the sensual expression. Major hang-up. The only hope you have in Christianity, if you really want to achieve Kedusha, you become a monk or a nun. Islam. Do you know that Muslims are not allowed to own alcohol? I'm not talking about drinking. They're not allowed to own alcohol. They're not allowed to touch it. Because alcohol is a substance that if you have enough of it, makes you purely physical. True, if you have the right amount, it can liberate certain Kedusha. But if you have a little too much, you become part of the scenery. No Kedusha left. Muslims are not allowed to own it. Right? Hindus. In the Hindu religion, marriage is considered a terrible concession. Right? Buddhists. In Buddhism, the highest path is completely celibate, completely ascetic. They do have a path that's called the householder's path, where they get married, but even those spend many months a year in celibate isolation. Wherever you look, any sect, any religion, the Far Eastern ones, always that. There was a man in England called Krishnamurti, just to give an example. He was a very evolved teacher. And you listen to his talks and his teachings. Very enlightened man. Came to England in the turn of the last century. A whole interesting story. He taught that marriage is evil. He taught that marriage is evil. Because when you get into the sensual and the physical, then the neshamas have it. The resolution of the conflict is to beat the body down into celibate ascent. There's only two solutions in the non-Jewish world. Either to control the body totally or to totally ignore the body. Totally ignore it. Let me give an example. Let me give you... Let's get the idea clear. Are we together? Avraham Avinu came on the scene and here's his finish. He said, the solution is not to ignore the body and transcend it, but to elevate it to the level of nature. We have to reunite the split that the Chet Adam Rishon caused. And the world said to him, you crazy. You are crazy. If you're going to start getting into the body, before you schlep the body up, it's going to schlep the neshama down. And they were right. It's awfully dangerous. There's no question about it. They're not fools. And he said, your solution means that the neshama flies and the world is never reunited. And the deepest motivation in all Torah is Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, is to reunite a fractured world. But let's think. Just think this through. First of all, the Medrash says, just 1 second. The Medrash says, Achos lanu katana, right? Shir Hashirim. We have a young sister. Achot lanu katana. We have a young sister. Says the Medrash in Shir Hashirim. Who is our young sister? Avraham Avinu. Why call him Achot? The word Ach in Hebrew means to stitch. He was the one who stitched together a torn world. By the way, brother and sister in Hebrew simply mean those who are connected more than non-relatives. Ach. La'ache means to stitch. Why is he called Achos lanu? Because he's the one who stitched together a torn world? The world of spirit and the world of physicality. He came to teach that the solution to the problem is not to leave the body where it is and fly spiritually. That's nice, beautiful, much easier, but that's never going to reform the unity that we set out as. And therefore the solution is to get into the money, but instead of letting it bring you down, you schlep it up. That's where we're going. Yes, there are exceptions, and I'll try to explain why those are. First of all, Moshe Ben is the only one who had to separate from his wife, and only because he had to be ready for Nebuah all the time. Ben Azai tried to get married and failed. He was too much in love with Torah. And the Leshem names 4 or 5 people who could not sustain marriage for various reasons and what the common element is among them. But that's not normative. Moshe Rabbeinu was unable to fulfill that mitzvah. You have to know what that means. Okay. By the way, you know what mitzvah means? Do you know what mitzvah means? Mitzvah means an act of kedusha in the body. Virtually all the mitzvahs are done with the body. Virtually all. There are 3 or 4 or 5 maybe that are not done with the body.
Moshe Rabbeinu got married naturally.
Of course.
4 months. Certainly.
Yeah.
So he's lacking. He's lacking the development of that eva.
No. For him, it's a kedusha. But his question is: if the ultimate purpose of Yiddishkeit is to get into Gashmias and to get married, why was he had to separate from his wife? It's a question. And the question has other expressions. Why in Yom Kippur do we not? Why or do we have times of split and separation? We'll try to deal with that if we can.
So simple Muslims speak about
Precious. We have to deal with that. Why do we have a mahalach of precious if it's wrong? Stay tuned.
Hello.
Are we on the other time?
Mario's at quarter past 8 meeting. The door's not locked.
Okay. So, just another few minutes. So, it's like this. The mitzvah, by the way, you know that Torah, all of Torah is consisting of duality, of male and female elements. In Torah, the duality is Torah and mitzvah. Torah is Zohar, mitzvah is Nekeva. Why? Torah is Yeruchnius, especially Torah Lishma, and mitzvah is where it comes into practical expression. Right? What is mitzvah? By the way, mitzvah does not mean commandment. Tzivui means commandment. Mitzvah has another connotation. As well as meaning tzivui, mitzvah means to combine. But savta chada means in one bond. Tzevet, the modern Hebrew word tzevet, means a crew, people who bonded together into a unit of function. Mitzvah means combining the kedusha of the tzivui in Ruchnius, filling it, fulfilling it, bringing it into the lamas. That's what mitzvah means, right? Avraham Avinu brought to the world the chiddush of recombining guf and neshama. He brought to the world not the kedusha of ruchnius, which is what Shem and Eva were doing. Shem and Eva were teaching the Torah of ki'ilu Buddhism. They were sitting in a mountaintop retreat, teaching the kedusha of transcendence. And Avraham Avinu came on the scene and he said, "That's fine, that's Torah, that's beautiful. The chiddush is we have to redeem the physical world." And they said to him, "You're crazy. As soon as you get people into the physical world, it's going to bring them down." And he said, "There's no other solution. We've got to schlep it up." Let's think of the rise. Slowly, let's build this up. First of all, the word Avraham is Gematria 248. The limbs of the body. Not Gematria Torah. Gematria, the limbs of the body, Avraham Avinu. The ultimate Kedusha of Avraham Avinu is Bris Milah. The ultimate symbol of taking the body and using it in Kedusha, right? Let's think through a few. Let's go through the questions we began with, see how this answers them, and see how this principle plays itself out. First of all, what did he bring to the world that they did not? They were teaching the Torah of Hashem. He was teaching the Torah of Hashem combined again with Gashmis. Why did Yaakov... let's start with that. Why did Rivka go ask a question of shame and not of Avraham Avinu? Because she was experiencing the dichotomy between Guf and Neshama. She walked past the place of Neshama, Torah, there was a response. She walked past the place of Gashmias, Esav, there was a response. Who did you ask about that split? Shame. Shame and Abel were the people who understood what it means to be up there in Kedusha and the problem and the lecherous, problematic, fallen element of the world. When you're dealing with that schism, you ask Shem, not Avraham. Avraham Avinu is the one who understands the unity of the two. When you're dealing with a problem and the tension, that's where you go. Let's think it through. What happened to Yaakov? Yaakov is on his way to the base Lavan. Who's Lavan? Lavan is the ultimate expression of split between Kedusha and between Ruchnias and Gashmias. Why? There are many ways to see it. We don't have time now fully, but I'll just give you one amazing insight into this. Alpi Kabbalah, which the Medrash mentions, Lavan was Bilam, you know that. Bilam was Lavan, right? You know the many rise to that, without going into that. Bilam was Lavan. You want to understand who Lavan was? By the way, the word Lavan means to whitewash. It means to be Kedusha on the outside, white garments. Masha Inke inside is the biggest tumor. Who was Bilam? Bilam was the highest Navi who ever lived. In some ways higher than Moshe Rabbeinu, and certainly on the same madrega as Moshe Rabbeinu. You don't get higher than that. Who was he in Gashmias? The Medrash says he married his donkey. I'm talking literally. Right? You know that the others rode a donkey that was male. Avraham Avinu rode a donkey that was a male donkey, right? A chamor. You know, chamor always means chomer, means in being in control of the material. Why will the Mashiach come riding a white donkey? What does that mean? Who cares how he comes? Bring him on the Concord. What's the difference? Riding a white donkey means being in control of, using as a vehicle, purified materialism. That's what it means. Bilam doesn't ride a chamor, he rides an aton, a lady donkey. And the Medrash is quite clear he married. Now, just one second. He's the highest Navi imaginable. And in Gashmias, he sinks into that. Answer is, these are separate worlds. What do you mean? These are separate worlds. Complete. Adarabba, becoming that Madrega involves the separation. And this theme, you know, there's a famous Western philosopher, famous philosopher. They found him one morning. Famous philosopher. Taught not only general philosophy but also ethics, moral philosophy. One morning they found him crawling out of a place of very, very low repute. So the student said to him, how can you be a philosopher and behave that way? He said, what's one got to do with the other? Does a mathematician have to be a triangle? What are you talking about? There's lumbus and there's practice. Those are two separate things. Not for us. So, when Yaakov Avinu is going to the base Lavan, he's going to live in the house of an individual whose problem is the split between the two. Lavan was very frum. Lavan was very frum in Kedusha, in Ruchnias. But he lived like an animal. When you go to live in a house like that, the Torah you need is Sheva Eretz Torah. Avraham and Yitzhak's Torah hadn't prepared him for that. To prepare him for that experience. And by the way, it's a beautiful raya. Beautiful raya. You know, if it doesn't speak to you, then there's something lacking. When he comes back from the base Lavan and he meets Esav, what does he say to him? This is the classic confrontation between the one who's involved in Kedusha, bringing Kedusha into Gashmias, and the one who lives Gashmias for Gashmias' sake, right? The separation. You know, some of Farshim say, I think Rav Gifter said, that you see that when Esav gets a brocha, Yitzchak's brocha to him is Mital Hashamayim Me'al. The dew of heaven is above you. You want to reach the dew of heaven, you've got to leave the physical. Yaakov's brocha is Mital Hashamayim U'mishmanei Haaretz. His bracha is the dew of heaven and the fat of the land. That's where he is the combination. When Yaakov... What?
A guy can only bring a carbon
oil. Like what?
A guy can only bring a carbon
oil. Yeah. So when Yaakov comes back to meet Esav, and what does he say to him? Im lavan garti. So Rashi says, garti is lashon tariyag. The OCS tariyag. What does it mean? I lived with lavan and I kept 613 mitzvahs. So the unschooled ear hears like this. I lived with a Rosh Lavan and I remained an Orthodox Jew. That's not what he said. He said mitzvahs. He didn't speak about Torah. That wasn't the problem in Lavan's house. The problem in Laban's house was bringing it into the Lamaisa of the Guf. That was the problem. See, that was a challenge, right? He'd prepared for 14 years in Shem Va'Avon's Torah, and that's where he is. Next, let's step.
So the issue was that he did mitzvahs there, it wasn't just that.
Of course not. The issue of staying in Kedusha and having his head in Torah wasn't the challenge. I'm sure that was a challenge too. But the point that he emphasized was, I lived in that house, and unlike Lavan, I was able to express it in Gashmias. I wasn't living with a donkey. I wasn't a Navi up there and at night living with a donkey.
Of
course, to get the body expressing Kedusha.
That's Avram Avinu.
Sure.
And that changed, so why didn't learn with Avram Avinu?
No, Avram Avinu is the one who is uniting the two. When you want to go live in Lavan's house, who teaches the split, then Shem Va'Avon is the one who teaches you the Torah of the split. It's getting late. Wherever you go, you'll see this idea. Let me just share with you one or two more. Why didn't they try to kill Shem Va'Avon? They weren't a problem. They weren't telling you how to live in your hands and feet and how to eat your bread and drink your wine. I don't know, but they were sitting on an ashram on a mountaintop. Let the tourists go and see him. It wasn't a problem. Avraham Avinu was the one who was a threat to him because he was teaching him. Wherever you go, you'll see this idea. Just share. Who? Avram. Because they were teaching. He was teaching how you have to live your life. Lemaisa, how you bring it down. What were they trying to do? They were trying to split the world. They said, Nasa imoy milchama. Let's go up to Hashem and split the world.
Why?
They wanted to run it themselves. They wanted to get down into Gashmias for its own sake. Esav's agenda. What's Esav's agenda? Is to run. Let me just share with you one.
So what was Shem Vav's agenda?
They were teaching Kedusha, but they didn't have the insight, the Chiddush that he had, that Kedusha can be expressed in the broken body, in the fallen, problematic body full of excrement that smells bad, that's given to its lusts and tivers and animal, that can achieve Kedusha. You know, in Kabbalah is written also that what tests you in the next world is the Kedusha in your body, not your neshama, because your neshama is never problematic. The biggest Rosha can say every morning, Yolakai neshama shenasata b'tahirin. The neshama is always tolerant. The problem is the nefesh. The problem is the nefesh. You know what koros means? Koros means the nefesh gets cut off, not the neshama. What's nefesh? Nefesh is the expression of life in the body. What the hallmark of kedusha for a yid is the kedusha in your guf. It's what your marriage looks like in your body. It's how you eat and drink. What's precious, by the way? Let's understand what precious is. You read, yeah. The major theme of Yiddishkeit is bringing kedusha into the body, right? Bris mila, etc. What's precious? Separation from the physical. So here's Rav Simcha Wasserman's insight, is what he said. Precious means separating from Gashmias for the sake of Gashmias. That means whenever you have a temptation to get into something physical for the sake of the physical, you have no right to be there. That is so dangerous, it's going to bring you down. But whenever you're using the physical for the sake of the Gashmias, whenever the physical is a vehicle and you're reuniting it, you're using, you're riding that donkey to get you to the goal, right, where you're in control, is then we're not into precious. What precious? We get married, we drink wine, we eat on Shabbos, we eat more. What precious? Precious, when you're eating an ice cream for the sake of eating an ice cream, you have no business doing that if you want to reach condition. But when you're eating food for the sake of what it's being used for, that's being transmuted into Kedusha, of course you have to eat the food. The ultimate expression is marriage, by the way. We don't even talk about that anymore these days because we're lucky, we're happy people are just normal. But the Ramban has a whole approach to the Kedusha of marriage. Yeah.
Bro, are you saying that Koros is only on
Hazard? No, I'm saying Koros is cutting, wherever it is, it's cutting off of the Nefesh.
But what Nefesh is on here? The Neshama always goes back, the Nefesh gets destroyed, so you're saying it can only be done?
The ultimate Tachlis is what's called Tchias HaMeisim. Tchias HaMeisim means not only nefesh, the whole body gets revived, and that's an ikkar, one of the 13 ikkarim in Torah. Goyim don't have that at all. Just one second, let's get this clear. Just one second. Where are you heading? Where are you heading ultimately? Machlokes is Tchias HaMeisim.
In
the
chelik,
it's
only your soul that's going to have the.
Yeah. Whose opinion? Whose opinion? The Rambam?
No.
Tchias HaMeisim, the ultimate madrega, the second Tchias HaMeisim, without going into the whole mahalach. The body will be here. There's a machlokes what the body will look like. How will the body be the body? Do you understand? Or the body be higher than your neshama looks now? But everybody agrees there'll be Orius and Kalim. Everybody, even the famous Rambam that you're referring to, that says in Tchias Samesim there's Ein Guf V'Gevir, etc., etc. The Machlokes between him and everyone else is only, yeah, there's no body like now. But there's all, Tchias Samesim is an Iker. Tchias Samesim is that the body and the soul are reconnected. That, you know why? Because you only got there through the Guf. There's two ways to see it. The only reason the Neshama got to where it got to was because it brought itself down into expression in a Guf. And the other way to say it is, some part of the Bria is going to be bottled. He created something that's going to be irrelevant. That's Achdus Hashem. Every blade of grass is going to be resurrected. Every grain of dust will be there, showing what it was meant to be doing.
Chazal said that Avram Avinu was mechav and all the mitzvahs on his own. Did Hashem made everybody the same?
I don't know.
They're speaking about how Avram Avinu wanted to do the same. Chazal speaks about all the mitzvahs. Hashem made everybody do this.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know what the expression of mitzvahs was.
Why?
I do not know what their expression in mitzvah was. Are they related to the world of mitzvah? I don't know.
We know that the Avos did related. We know according to Chazal the Avos did related.
That's the Avos. But what was Shem Vayavu? Were they into Shem Mitzvahs Bnei Nerach only? Did they have another Musak? I don't know. Let me just
also to from Ha'av Avram then, because they
could say that. Yeah. But I don't know. I'm only saying what I know for sure, what I heard from Rav Moshe. I can't make up.
So what does it mean they were teaching authentic Torah?
Teaching
that,
what?
That authentic Torah, they were teaching, they were learning the Sefer Brachos, they were learning, I'm saying they were learning the mitzvahs.
But that's what he's asking. I don't know what the expression in mitzvah was. I can't answer that. They were learning Torah.
Because once they're teaching mitzvahs, the mitzvahs are
Torah,
physical.
Torah.
Torah, once they're teaching
I don't
Torah.
Know what aspect of mitzvah
also
learned
Torah, what's the expression?
Yeah.
The Malachim also learned Torah. Hashem learns Torah. What's his expression?
They're teaching Torah and they're teaching the
let me say, let me say what Rav Asher means. What Rav Asher means is like this. In every madrega, there's equivalence. Yeah. What looks like a mitzvah to you here, one madrega higher doesn't look the same. When a Malach learns Torah, he also has 613 elements in his Torah. What does Loish Signov look like to him? Not the same as it looks to you. He's learning the Sherish of that thing. Adam Rishim and Gan Eden didn't have Loish Sinov. It wasn't even possible. He was learning the Sherish of that in. Do you understand? That was the Malachim's argument. What do you mean you're going to bring it down there? He said, I don't know, but this is where it belongs. That sort of Torah. Shem Va'ev were learning that root type Torah. Yes, the roots, which is higher, much higher. But the Chiddush of Avraham is that this is where it belongs down here. Let me just add one more idea, if I may, and I'll stop there. Just, there are many places this goes, many other places, but I'll just say one more. Dina. Gemara says like this.
Might as well call it 2-8 or whatever it was, sorry.
Gemara says like this. Gemara says, a person who learns Torah without practicing mitzvah, even his Torah is not Torah. A person who learns, and he doesn't practice, even his Torah, why not? The guy's learning. The person's learning. No, it's the kola Torah kola. He doesn't happen to practice. Why is his Torah not Torah? Teretz, Torah's Avraham Avinu is only Torah. That's shaykh to be. If it's not, it's Shem Va'eva's Torah. Torah's Avraham Avinu is the Torah that only called Torah when it's to be put into practice. Second example. Gemara says that a person who learns Torah and doesn't practice mitzvahs should have died at the point of birth. The Lashon in the Gemara is shenefcha shil yosoy al pamot, that his mother's placenta should have covered his face and smothered him at birth. Right? And he should have died as he's being born. That's a person who grows up to become a gogol in Torah, but he doesn't express it in Maaseh. Such a person should have died at the point of birth. Here's Rav Shapira's insight into it. You have to be Rav Shapira to touch it like this, but this is what he said. What's peculiar about dying at the point of birth? Chazal don't use loose examples. What's peculiar about dying at the point of birth? What does that mean? It means this. What's unique about a child in the womb? What's unique about a child in the womb is that he's taught the whole Torah. A Malach teaches him the whole Torah. As he's born, he forgets the Torah. And he comes out into the world with a different purpose. So what is a child in the womb? He is a being who has maximum Torah. He knows the whole Torah, but he's unable to practice. If you're going to grow up to be a person who has Torah with no practice, you'll never have it as good as you had it as a child in the womb. That's the moment to leave them. That's what you're after. There's no better time to leave them then. After 9 months of pregnancy, when you know the whole Torah, and you're not aiming to put it into practice, they're not pointing. You'll never be that high. The only point in being born is to be a person who can now come into a world where he can bring it into the Lamaisin. But a person who's not going to do that, that's the moment that he needs to go. You see this, every place you look, you see, this is the Chibur, right? It's not just Musa. It's not just Musa that, you have to practice your Torah. It's not just Musa. That's what our Torah is. It's a Torah that is Lishma, which means totally up there. And yet, if you're not going to, it's not Shaykh to be brought down wherever it can be, there's not Torah either, right? It's the
Well, first
comes
by mitzvah when you can start having children.
Exactly. That's what Das is. Das is Loshen Chibur. That's what marriage is. I said bleed notice. Just one more final one. More. The Gaon says,
come
you see
the 3 years.
That's right. The Gaon says, you see this in wine. Can I get two more examples? You want five?
Three.
Okay. The Gaon says, you see this in wine. Wine, that the Goyim, right, have a tremendous problem. In the non-Jewish world, wine is either completely abstained from or tremendously overindulged. Massive problem. In Torah, everything is symbolized. Any time we make a chibur of good for neshama, we take wine. You know, we're so used to it as Jews, we don't even notice. Here are two people getting married. Two people getting married. The ultimate potential for getting into Gashmis that we want to transmute into Kedusha, we take a cup of wine. Bris Mila. We're taking the ultimate expression of sensuality in the world and giving it the ability to transcend, we take a cup of wine. Shabbos. When the Gashmias of the week transcends into the Kedusha of Shabbos, we take it. By the way, Havdalah is no different. Havdalah is where you bring in the Kedusha of Shabbos. That's real Yiddishkeit, even more than Kiddush. When you're taking the Kedusha of Shabbos to bring it into a week, that it should be higher next Shabbos than you were the one before, you're making a chibur of the two. Havdalah, for the purpose of bringing one into the other. Connection.
Where's this going?
I don't know where the Kohen Yisrael says this, but it's a famous and well known thing. If you remind me, I'll use the internet. Or the disc, you know, the disc with the Kairos, and I'll look it up for you. But I guarantee you it's valid. The Gaon says like this. It's based on the Chazal that says, Nichnas Yain Yatzah Soid. Right? When Yain wine goes in, the secret world comes out. Right? It gives expression to that. It says the Gaon, why wine? Because wine is the one unique substance, class of substances, that does not obey the rules of the physical, but obeys the rules of the spiritual. Physical things always get worse with time. All physical things wind down, grind down, disintegrate with time. Spiritual things get better with time. Chokhmah, as it develops. Wine, unlike all other physical things, gets
salt.
Better with time.
Salt also.
What?
Melach
preserves. Doesn't get better. Salt preserves, stops deterioration. But wine improves with time. So it's an avenue of access into the world of Kedusha, right? And therefore, we, you know, in non-Jewish culture, where do you come from? America, England? Wherever you come from, there's a legal age of buying alcohol and drinking. Do you know what that means? It means you've got to be 18, in some places you've got to be 21. In Torah, kid's 8 days old, you're putting it in his mouth. 8 days old, you're dripping it in his mouth. What's the problem with wine? They have an immense problem with this, one way or the other, right? And for us, that's the ultimate symbol of the chibur. I'll just give you one more example. And it's this. Just briefly. You know that... If I asked you, what expresses most clearly the limitation of the world? In other words, where do you see that the world is completely limited? There's no ability to transcend. Cannot connect with Kedusha, with Rav Meir's. Philosophically, I think you could see that a very powerful expression of that is in the notion of measurements. Midah, you know, midah is commercial 49. 50 is where you transcend. 49 is 7 times 7 elements of the world. Measurements are what limit the world. The world of Asiya that we live in is the world that's limited by measurement, has boundaries. Now, what is the concept of measurement in Torah? This is wild. Wild. So, first of all, what's the concept of measurement in the non-Jewish world? For example, in the decimal system, what defines a measurement? There's a bar of platinum in Paris in the Institute of Standards that is 1 meter long under certain conditions of temperature and pressure. That is the world standard for the meter. Of course, there has to be one. If you don't have one defining standard, you... All over the world... Centimeters, millimeters, centimeters, etc., are taken from the standard meter that's kept in Paris by the Institute of Standards. And it does not vary at all because that's the definition of a measure. Now, in Torah, what is a measure? The answer is, it depends. For example, you have a tefach. A tefach is 9.8, 10 centimeters, whatever it is, right? It's a tefach. So Moses says like this, there's two kinds of tefach. There's a limited tefach, which is like this. It's called a tefach atzuv, a sad tefach. And there's one that's slightly expanded called a tefach seichek, smiling, a happy tefach. Happy tefach? You know, next time you have a builder do some work for you, tell him you want it out of happy feet, you know? What are you doing? there's a whole machlekes in Midas about the Midas of the third base of Mikdash. Are the Amos going to be Amos? Which of the Amos are sad? Which are happy? The ones of the Mizbeach are like this. There's a whole machlekes. Which of the Amos are constricted ones? What's going on? You're talking to an engineer, right? A cold, logical, and you're telling him now we're going to have measurements, and then you tell him, but the measurements depend. There's sad ones. That's terrible. The message here is that in the most definitive constricted element of the world, how you measure the world, there's room for expansion. You understand? There's a potential to go beyond, even in the measurements. Okay, anyway, the concept that we studied here this evening is the concept that Avraham Avinu brought to the world. No doubt he was a founder of Kiruv and outreach and spreading Hashem's name in the world. No doubt there are other approaches to this issue, but one amazing avenue of insight here, which you see time and again, is that the Torah you have to learn has to be the Torah that is ultimately transcended, completely outside the world, Torah Lishma, and yet you're not considered to be a child of Avraham Avinu unless that Torah has the kind of power that enables it to shut the body up. Dangerous, problematic, yes, but despite that, the avodah is to bring the guf into the, to bring the neshama into the guf. Since I didn't say bleed it on the last example, I'll just mention one more, and that's this. You know that, I promise you I'll finish with this. There's a famous kasha, which is this. In Nishmas Kol Chai, right? In Nishmas we say, that ilu filu malei shira, if our mouth was full of song, right? Thanks, kayam, like the ocean. Beinenu iris kashemesh b'chayarech, and our eyes were light like the sun and the moon, yeah? Etc. In other words, and yadenu prusa is kenishrei shemayim, if our hands were stretched out like eagle's wings. Basically, if we had the expanse of the whole world at our command, and we try to use the whole expanse of the universe within our organs to express Hashem's praise and relate to Him, en anachnu maspikim, we would not manage. Ilu filu, if our mouth was filled with song like the sun, like the sea, and our eyes like the sun, etc., en anachnu maspikim, we wouldn't manage lohedus lecha Hashem to express anything about you. Al achas me alef elef alafe alafim, we wouldn't manage a millionth of a zillionth of a billionth of a trillionth of what relates to you. Well, naturally, if we had the whole size of the cosmic reality at our experience, it's still finite. Hashem's infinite. No matter how big you are in the finite, it's nothing compared to the infinite. And therefore, we wouldn't manage. Posh it, right? Two lines later, Al-Kain, Eivarim Shipilaktavon. Therefore, these limbs and organs, that the same things we spoke about before, the hands, the feet, Henen Yudav Ivarchavish, they'll do the job. They'll say your praises. Two lines before you said that if you gave us our organs and our limbs and our faculties, the expanse of the universe, we wouldn't begin a zillionth of a trillion. So therefore, we'll do it, no problem. Talk about a stereo, two lines. So there's a famous answer Ruchaim Oizer gave here, which is so Jewish, you know, just his answer was like this. It's completely impossible. Oh, who cares? We'll do it anyway. Like the Balei Musa say, don't ask if it's possible. Ask only if it's necessary. I once asked Ramesh who said that, and he said they all said it. Don't ask if a thing's possible. That's not your job as a Jew. Ask if it's necessary. If it's necessary, you do it. Possibility's got nothing to do with you. But there's another mahalach here, and that's this amazing thing. Nishmas Kol Chai. You know what Nishmas is? Nishmas is the tefillah of the neshama, right? Nishmat Kol Chai. Which neshama? It's the tefillah of the neshama Yosera. You say Nishmas on every day when you have a neshama Yosera. And you have to say it, by the way. If you miss other things, you can't miss this. You have to say Nishmas. Nishmas is rise for this, so I'm not going to now. Nishmas is the tefillah of the neshama Yosera. What's the neshama Yosera? On Shabbos, you get an extra neshama, extra soul. What does it mean? You become schizoid on Shabbos? That's why you got to eat extra for the other. Neshama Yosera doesn't mean you get two neshamas. It means you get more neshama. What does it mean, more neshama? More neshama means the neshama comes more into the guf. That's what it means. What does it mean you get more neshama? It means the physicality is more enlightened, more voltage is pumped into the guf from the neshama. You eat more on Shabbos, not because you've got two neshamas. You eat more on Shabbos because the gashmias of eating, which during the week is likely to bring the neshama down, is safer on Shabbos. On Shabbos, when the guf is more imbued with neshama, right? And therefore the teretz is like this. The limbs and organs that you gave us, since they are finite and physical, couldn't begin to relate to you. But on Shabbos, when the limbs and organs of the body are enlightened and powered by a deep, a more vibrant expression of the Shama, they can do their job. Right? The hallmark of a Yid is how deeply into your body the Kedusha goes. That's the measure. Shabbos, there's more. Right? Shabbos is not for leaving the world. What Shabbos is when you get more into the world. What? It's more Kedusha. Right? That's the idea. Okay, that's the basic idea. And that is a more sophisticated approach to the Chiddush of Avraham Avinu. I'm sure all the other approaches are correct as well. But that is a sophisticated approach to a more mature approach, perhaps, to the Chiddush, which is the establishment of a unity which had previously broken down.